On Audit Human Service Budget Reform for Thursday, January 30th. Welcome back, everybody. I was thinking about putting the committee into recess and going into the audience. It looked like you were all having so much fun, and I know that all these sidebar conversations were relevant to the topic at hand. So we have back with us Rocky King, obviously, from the talk on private market health insurance, employee-sponsored health insurance. But we also have at the dais today Joel Aereo, the administrator for the Oregon Insurance Division. Rocky's going to finish up with OMIT, and then Joel will come in with answer any questions we may have as it relates to some of the other insurance that comes out of OMIT. And Joel will give us a presentation on health insurance overview. What the insurance division does and how it fits into this whole thing. Before we begin, let's hear from Mr. Bacovian.
Take a chair. In your packet right behind your agendas are some information that I put out in our handouts. The first item is a copy of a letter from the governors of Colorado, Connecticut, and Florida to President Bush regarding his looking at some Medicaid reform issues, and that's just more of an FYI. If you do have responses to this letter at some point and you read it and you feed them back to me, I will give them to our representative at the National Conference of State Legislatures. She's collecting input from lawmakers about these ideas in this letter. And then behind that letter are a couple of fact sheets that were done by committee services. One's on health insurance, and the other was just a health statistics fact sheet. These are just FYI again, if you need it later.
I would personally recommend the health insurance. This is one of the best briefs I've ever read. Rick has put out a couple others, one on the health plan, and
what was the other one I read?
Prescription drugs, PATH, or did seven or eight of them.
Must have made quite an impression on me since I can't remember the title of it. But,
or, just can't remember.
Yeah, it did make quite an impression on just reaching that age. No, it's that afternoon. I haven't had the cookies that have been provided. We better have cookies, Kelly.
Well, look, run out, Dr. Bates, and get that carafe of coffee that's in
the...
Anyway, I particularly encourage the committee to read some of these briefs done by our guest committee staff.
Ooh.
These are good. That, let me turn it over.
Mr. Chair?
Go
you.
Ahead, sir.
For the
you
record,
better not end this on a light note.
Do not end?
On with any levity.
Okay.
Please, all the levity you can muster is...
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. Also with me is Joel Aereo, who is the administrator for the insurance division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're going to try to divide today's up into kind of two sections. One, I'm going to try to go through OMIP, and then Joel is here to talk a little bit about functions of the insurance division. We may also want to avail ourselves of the opportunity while he's here to talk a little bit about the insurance mandates, which are contained within Section 7 of the book that I gave you, and after OMIT, maybe that's something that we want to get into. First, three quick points. First of all, I want to thank you for what I think is an extraordinary opportunity to meet with you over two or three days like this. I don't think in the 13 years I've been here there's ever been a committee that's got together who just basically said, we want to absorb this so much information before you get in to make some of the real tough, critical decisions that you're going to have to make over the coming months. And I think that really speaks well for the chair and all the members here. Secondly, I just want to again put the disclaimer. There are some folks here up front and in the back that sometimes will have better technical knowledge than me, and I hope that they will, as Bruce Bishop does, start shaking his head no when he disagrees with me so that Representative Cruz can call on him and get him to give him the facts. Okay. We're kind of going to just give you a brief overview of OMIP, the high-risk pool. And I talked about, if you remember, the late 1980s, high premiums, people were being turned down in the group market for health reasons, individual market. You drove past a hospital and blinked at it, and an insurer found out about it. They were losing money, so they sure didn't want to take the risk of having you come into the pool. And there were a number of individuals, and I think this really started out of then-Senator Kitzhaber, Senate Majority Leader Bill Bradbury, and a few other individuals that really started looking at putting the concept of a high-risk pool forward. Interesting note, we have more insurance commissioners that still work for the state. I mean, between Mike Greenfield over at Education, you've got Corey Streisinger, the current administrator. But you got Gary Weeks, who is an insurance commissioner during the 91 reforms, the major reforms. And then we have also the current governor, who is the insurance commissioner when OMIP first was put on the table in front of the legislature. And it was really fell to his lap to work with the insurance carriers to get it going in 1987 and 1989. Started as a state agency in 89, first policy issued in July of 1990. And as we've talked in length, in 1997, we've provided the portability option when prior to the federal action, the state stepped ahead of the feds and said, we're going to make sure that everybody has portability either in the private sector or through OMIP, that loss of group coverage did not mean loss of coverage. It just meant you went to another plan administered by either the same company or by OMIP.
What page, Mr. Chair? What page are we
on? We're
sorry.
The OMIP. It's
slide 39.
Mr. Chair, slide 39. My book just opens automatically to these pages. So it's
can we trade books?
No. You can trade with Representative Anders.
Since 1990, almost 30,000 Oregonians have been enrolled in OMIP, and we currently have about 9,300. I will tell you that when we first started, we thought we'd have a cap of 4,000, but we have over the years exceeded that by 4,000 to 5,000. There are 30 other states that have high-risk pools. I think we were about the 12th or 13th in the nation. And since that time, an additional 18 have been added. I'm very supportive, obviously, as the administrator of high-risk pools. But I think nationally, there's really only four states that I think meet the criteria that I kind of established as what I call successful pools. And that's Oregon, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. It's very difficult, for example, to go to a state like California, has 30 million people in that state, approximately 25% uninsured population, and find out they only have 15,000 people in a high-risk pool, or Texas with 30 million people, 25% uninsured rate, and only 20,000 people in the risk pool. Oregon, Wisconsin, Nebraska, and Minnesota, however, when you look at percentages of populations, have really done a good job, I think, both as a percent of the overall population as well as the uninsured population, as well as the population in the individual market. Remember, that's where we get our folks. People are denied coverage, have done pretty good. Oregon, 9,000. Nebraska has, I think, 4,000 to 5,000 enrolled, and it's a smaller state than us. Minnesota has 30,000 in the risk pool. Wisconsin, I think, has 12 or 13,000. So four states that I think have really done a pretty good job. The other reason they've been successful is each one of those states have premiums that are closer to the private market sector. One reason why Texas doesn't have a lot of folks there is they're at 175% of an average premium that you would pay if you were accepted into the private sector. So a lot of the pools, while they're there in name, are not there in terms of economic access. Oregon, our premiums, and I'll talk about that a little later, are established by statute at no more than 125%, but the board has kept those relatively low. It's about 107 to 110% of the average, so not much of a surcharge. Minnesota, historically, has been about 105%. Wisconsin has a subsidy program to help low-income people get into their program. I think that's helped them. So I think these states are reflective of not only good cooperation within the private sector and the public sector, but also of pretty good policies about giving people some economic access by not charging them just exorbitant surcharges to get in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, Rocky, decade long plus a little bit. You've had 30,000 enrolled. You got 9,000 current. What is the reason for people disenrolling? It's not a lot of churning, but it's some. So what is the reason for the churning here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, there are three major reasons people, I think, moving out of the pool when we look at those statistics, and I can get those for you in greater detail. Number one reason people leave the pool is Medicare.
Okay.
Either Medicare disability, but more generally because they turned 65. Our average age is 50 years old. And if you took out a little section of kids in there, there's very few people between 20 and 40. You took out some of the kids, you'd be closer to 55 years of age in terms of the average age of the pool. More than 50% of enrollees then are above 50 right now. So Medicare is number one. Other coverage, generally group coverage, is number two. People finally get a job and move into group coverage. And then you have a whole assortment of things. Medicaid, people who just finally can't afford the premiums and have dropped down below the federal poverty level. And you have deceased. We have a high number of people that die every year. It's interesting. We have people that come into the pool for very short periods of time. It's a transition, 4 months, 6 months, 2 months, until they find something else. And we have a whole set of people that generally are the older ones that will stay in it for the 4 or 5 years until they become eligible for Medicaid or Medicare.
So we've got, Mr. Chair, we've got people going out the top because of age, out the bottom because of income, and out the side because of economics. Okay.
Yep. And it's not because they're dying.
Did I say that? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to continue, slide 40 shows you the growth in the enrollment. Remember that the best time we had in this state from an uninsurance standpoint was 1996, and that's when the trend started back up. We were at about 11%. Again, 2002, the estimate is about 14%. You add portability coverage that started in 97. And you can see that we really have taken off in the last 4 or 5 years. The bottom line, it shows 65 enrollees are people who are eligible for Medicare and elect to stay in the pool, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. The pool was never really designed to be a subsidy program in the sense of premiums. People were always expected to pay their premiums coming into this pool. So one might say it wasn't for poor folks. The reality is 41% earn under $25,000 a year. It has been a program that a lot of low-income folks have accessed. 73% earn under $45,000 a year. This is not a pool full of a lot of rich folks. It's folks that are struggling day to day just like everybody else. Again, 61% female, and average age is 50 years. Why do people get into the pool? I wish that I could give you the full list. It is just long, but high blood pressure, back condition, mental disorders, allergies, high cholesterol, arthritis, diabetes, asthma, heart condition, headaches, usually meaning by that migraine. It's just almost any reason, multiple sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. It's just amazing the number of conditions. There is, other than high blood pressure, no real one that sticks out, that in back and skeletal conditions. Premium cost, slide 43. Our average premium cost is $348 per policy. The average claim is $652. The difference between that, we'll talk about, is made up through assessments of insurers. As you can see, our premium since 1996 has steadily climbed, just like the private sector has. Our claims have climbed just like the private sector has.
And that gap is made up by the contribution from...
Through the assessment, Mr. Chair, right. And we will get that in about three or four pages here, I think.
Okay.
We'll get into some of the funding.
Representative March.
These people have been turned down or for regular insurance or an agent said that they wouldn't even try to process them, basically.
Sure, that's correct.
And yet I see some of these conditions here, allergies, high cholesterol maybe, arthritis, are not, headache, are not what you would consider normal health reasons to turn someone down. So people are coming into this pool not for what we picture the big medical reasons, like, oh, they've had cancer, or, you know, well, the high blood pressure maybe, but you don't see heart attack listed there. Where are these, you know, so it comes back to how did they get the high risk, and are they appropriately here?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative March, if you have allergies and you are on some sort of pharmaceutical, taking a drug for that, I will tell you that an insurer in today's market, where margins have been squeezed, you're going to have a tough time getting in. Or if you have high cholesterol or arthritis, or especially diabetes, times are good. You're going to see them loosen what we call loosen the underwriting, and more of these folks are going to be able to get in. But these aren't necessarily, there are another, you know, 100 reasons that people get in. Agents will usually be pretty careful about who they say, there's no sense going through 60 days of hoops, let's just write a letter and get you into the pool. It's not going to be for somebody that has a marginal kind of illness. It's going to be somebody who's had cancer, who's been in the hospital. It's not going to be somebody who just says, I had a headache last week.
A follow-up. I've heard of cases where people are being turned down on the basis of credit ratings and things like that. That's been a problem in some states. Is that a problem, you think, in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Joel. He may have some information on that.
That is a problem in the property and casualty lines, but it's not a problem in the health line.
Okay. Joel, could you ID yourself for the record?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario, and I'm the insurance administrator.
Thank you.
I agree with your question, though, because, I mean, the impression I have is these are more significant, you know, type ailments, and we see the highest one is blood pressure, and I'm not doubting your answer at all. It's just I have the same question. Representative Bates.
I'm going to try to help the insurance companies in this one a little bit, Mr. Chair. It's sold out, right? The conditions you're looking at here, surprisingly, are extremely expensive in many cases over a period of time. And you wouldn't think that maybe hypertension is that big a deal. It leads directly to heart attacks and stroke, as an example, which are incredibly expensive. When the insurance companies turn these people down on an individual basis, they're just protecting their assets and protecting what they're doing, knowing that that patient will go to OMIP and they'll have an assessment against them which they'll pay. So they're not walking away from these people entirely. They're saying, we really can't insure you. We want you to go in the pool where everybody shares the risk of your health insurance, equal, saying everybody, meaning the other insurers in the state with me. If it weren't for OMIP and they turned down for these reasons, I'd have some real policy questions and that, and some moral questions. But when an insurance company has a tight situation and says, we are not going to insure these, knowing they'll go to OMIP and I will be assessed for that, that seems reasonable to me, and that's what this program's all about. And you've kept the premiums reasonable for those people going over. So it's you got to look at the kind of whole picture here before you start painting a black picture against the insurers.
And Mr. Chair, I haven't provided you with any claim information, but if you look at OMIP claims, it'll be cancer, heart disease, a lot of back surgery, mental health, pharmaceutical. 22% of our claims are pharmaceutical. So these are really self-reported conditions that people feel keep them out. It does not necessarily represent the claims costs that they incur once they get into the pool. The other thing, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Bates said it well, the mission of the pool is to provide access to people denied health coverage in the private sector, but it has a larger goal. One of the things the state could do is say, let's do guaranteed issue in the individual market. Anybody who wants health insurance, they could walk in and get it on demand, similar to what we do with Medicaid. What you would end up then is what we call, through adverse selection, all those with medical conditions getting insurance when they needed to get it taken care of, those folks holding it back, a large number of them, when they didn't. So you would, in essence, put insurance companies in a position of extraordinary claims with limited and a smaller amount of premiums coming into the system. Or the other option you could have is that everybody with a health condition went to one carrier and not to the others, and it would put that carrier at a great disadvantage. The purpose of risk pools nationally, in addition to providing access, is to provide for a stable individual market so that a lot of carriers can get in the market, stay in the market, and not get hurt through adverse selection or people just moving in and out. So I think that gets to what Representative Bates was talking about.
Let me just add a little bit to that, because we debated that long and hard in the 95 legislative session. What should we do in the individual market to try to reduce the amount of dependence we had on the high-risk pool? For the reasons Rocky cited, we chose not to impose guaranteed issue on that marketplace. Our neighbors to the north, Washington, did go to a guaranteed issue market, and over the next few years what happened there was a gradual erosion of the marketplace. Insurers pulled out, and in the end there weren't any. There wasn't a viable individual market. There just weren't insurers willing to insure in that kind of marketplace. I think guaranteed issue in the individual market probably only makes sense if it's combined with a mandatory purchase of insurance. But as long as people can opt in and out to allow them to just come in when they want to come in and then go out when they want to go out, is a very difficult proposition for the insurance community.
No, I was just agreeing. That's pretty much says it.
So, Mr. Chair, on slide 44 and 46, I'll go through eligibility real quickly with you.
Read that fast.
Turn down for individual coverage. Health benefit coverage was involuntarily terminated, i.e. a plan just closes. An agent refuses to apply for benefits on their behalf because of the health conditions. Again, I went over the changes we've seen primarily because of the high rejection rates. In portability, you have to exhaust your COBRA benefits if they're available to you. Or a portability plan is not available, i.e. a self-insured plan. Or you move to Oregon and have 18 or more months of continuous coverage. The last was group coverage. So we, like all the states, that's really a federal law, all the states have the same requirement. If you move from one state to another and you've been enrolled for 18 months in continuous coverage, then the other state will provide a guaranteed issue product. For us, it's the high-risk pool. On page 46, in 1999, we also passed Senate Bill 516, which would allow members to keep OMIP coverage after becoming eligible for Medicare. Prior to that, once you became eligible for Medicare, either Medicare disability or Medicare due to age, we basically terminated your enrollment in OMIP. The board decided, based on this and put forth this statute, that it would allow people that had been in the pool for 12 months and they purchased Medicare Parts A and B, that they could elect to pay the full premium and stay in the pool. And the only ones that do that are people who have high prescription drug costs. In our regular population, 20 to 22% of our claims is prescription drug. In the 65 people who've chosen to stay there, 75 to 80% of our claims are prescription drug. Now, one might say, well, why don't we just let everybody come in at the age of 65 and a half and get into the pool and keep Medicare or keep OMIP when they get Medicare, and that way they can get the prescription drug cost covered. The reality is, and the board took a look at this, because we have advocates that talk to us about that, that OMIP alone can't be the national solution to prescription drug coverage for Oregon senior citizens. So while they recognize that as a problem, they really felt they couldn't open it to everybody. It would put undue burden on all Oregon taxpayers, because ultimately we would get that money back through the assessment process. However, they did want to make a statement that somebody who's been in our plan, who's played the game, paid the premiums, that just because they turned 65, we weren't going to turn them out the door, as long as they've been there 12 months.
So that's why that number is actually so low.
That's correct.
Because you'd think there'd be a much larger demand than 65 represents, but the screen is that they had to be in OMIP coverage for 12 months prior to them going being eligible for Medicare.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Now, the one negative is we require they pay full premium, so we lose some people simply for economics. They can't afford to pay the Medicare premiums, Part A and B, plus pay the OMIC premium.
Mr. Chair, I would assume that if we took a harder look at that, we'd find that the people that are still in have a monthly drug costs higher than the premium, and those that didn't aren't still in. It's probably basically that simple.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think that'd be correct, except for those who can't just afford it, even regardless.
Yeah.
Yep. On the next chart, slide 47, it'll show you kind of what's gone on in the private sector. That's few people in Plan 1. That's the indemnity plan. Up to about 1996-97, we still had the majority of people in an indemnity plan. Since that time, they've all moved over to basically the PPO plan. Our managed care plan has gone down some, and that's primarily because it isn't offered as in Southern Oregon and some other pockets of Oregon as they used to. There just isn't the managed care network. I should tell you, we every 3 years do a request for proposal to select a third-party administrator to run the program for us, eligibility claims, and in essence hire their network. And Blue Cross Blue Shield has been with us since day one, a great partner. We use their network, PPO, and discounted rate systems throughout the state. When somebody from OMIP walks in, they're carrying a Blue Cross Blue Shield card. It has OMIP on it, but the big logo is Blue Cross Blue Shield. So they're treated just like any other Blue Cross Blue Shield client. I will tell you the problem we're running into today is if one of our clients calls a doctor's office and says, I'm from OMIP and would like to make an appointment, we're finding more and more doctors are saying, no, I'm sorry, we don't take OMIP clients. They're confusing OMIP and OMAP. They don't take Medicaid OMAP folks anymore, and they're starting to confuse some of the private sector paying customers in terms of the rates they pay with that. And we're working with Scott Gallant and the OMA to get a number of publications out there to make sure people understand there is a difference between Medicaid, OMAP, and OMIP, the high-risk pool. On the next chart, in the next couple pages, I'm going to talk a little bit about the funding. I said medical premiums cannot exceed 125% of the rates established as applicable for individual risk. Basically, what that means is we look at carriers that offer the same plans, do a weighted average, make some adjustments for differences in benefits, and take 125% of whatever rates they charge, and somewhere between 100 and 125, the board establishes what they think is a fair and equitable rate. And as I said, right now, they're at about 107%, and that's following a 18% increase in the premiums from last year. So the OMIP folks received an 18%. 4% of that was in a benefit reduction. We did reduce some of the benefits, and a little over 14% was in a premium increase. Portability premiums, however, are set at 100% of the standard, meaning that we go to the major carriers that provide portability coverage, say, what do you charge? We have the exact same benefit as them, and we charge exactly what they charge. We're not in competition with them, because people who get into our portability coverage can't have a portability option in the private sector. So we don't want to penalize anybody for having to end up in our portability. So it is at 100%. We do make a little interest earned on money we place in reserve. We have about 6 months reserve in order to pay claims through that six-month period. It declines. At the end of 6 months, we have zero and have to go out and get some more. But we do earn some money. But primarily, our assessments of insurers and reinsurers, including self-insured cities, counties, and school districts, it's about a 2 million lives in the, I think it's 1.8-something lives that we assess throughout the state. Once a year, we contact 1,200 insurers. About 180 of those actually have people that are enrolled in an insurance or reinsurance product in the state. And based on their number of lives that they have, that's what their assessment. We're going to lose $1 million, and there are 2 million lives, and ODS has 1 million, and you know they're going to pay 50% of the loss. So it's apportioned on the basis of lives, not premiums.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, looking back to your chart on 43, where it appears we have a fairly steep escalator, and in cost, is the automatic escalator and assessment going to make up for that, or are we looking for an increase in assessment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I'll ask you to turn to chart number 50.
Yeah. You got to read ahead.
Yeah, you got to read ahead. He can't read. See, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, herein lies OMIP's a great program, and it provides great access to a lot of Oregonians. But herein lies the real dynamic that I think is tough for insurers, tough for policyholders, tough for a lot of folks, and that is the increasing assessment that we've seen since 1990. You know, we, for a long time, averaged about 50 cents per month per insured. And starting in 99, when we started seeing the rejection rates go up by insurers, we started seeing the economy, the number of uninsured go up, so has that assessment. I encourage you, and I probably should draw a trend line through this, not to necessarily look at the every 6 months up and downs, but kind of look at the trend, because it's very hard when you have 9,000 folks to project what you're going to need exactly for that next 6 months. I mean, all you need is, you know, $200 or $300 million claims. We don't have very many of those, or $500,000 claims, and that throws you off quite a bit. But we've seen that go up to $1.39, and I think I shared with you that that means that the PEB board with 104,000 members is, you know, at $150,000 a month through the system to support this. If you're a small employer and you're paying an average of $300 per individual enrolled, $1.39 per month is funneling through that system. And it's a continuing concern that the board has. Obviously, the carriers don't like it, even though they pass it on. It is a small piece of the premium increases. But I will say it's small. You go back to 1996, when our premium average was in the $220, 40 cents was the assessment. Now our average is $350 per individual, and we're $1.39. So even though we've gone up threefold then, in terms of a percent of the premium of what's charged to most Oregonians, it hasn't gone up at that same rate. But it's not small change. It's not small change.
That was how many employees in the PEB system? 110, 120?
Well, no, members. About 104,000.
104?
Yeah, I think there's, 44,000 or something like that, actually, that are employees that are covered. But once you count dependents, because this assessment applies to all lives covered by a carrier.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you. I was trying to track on this graph, and of course it varies a whole lot there. There does seem to be a significant increase shortly thereafter, assuming time for things to trigger in here, but did portability add significantly to this when that became a part of your offer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, portability does add to this. We have about 1,500.
Well, I mean to the cost differential, obviously, because you're charging the same premium rate, and it's still at the high end as far as utilization.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, it does. And if you'll look at page or section, OMIP chart, section 12 of the book, if you have it, and you can go back to page, I want to say it's in the 9. Page 9,
okay.
I don't know if you can see it, the colored chart,
mm-hmm.
Looks like that. You'll see that the loss ratios, these are loss ratios, for every dollar that we take in, how much do we pay out in claims? The loss ratios for portability since inception are at 172%. Medical is only 168%. So, yes, the affordability plans have provided the same losses as those medical. And so you add 1,500 more folks, that adds to your assessment. Now, one of the key things when you talk about this is the primary driver of the increase in assessment has not been the increase in loss ratios. The loss ratios have been consistent. If you go back and look at that chart on page 9, for the last 5 years, every dollar of premium, we lose $1.75. The problem is that our enrollment has grown, doubled, but the number of people that we assess in the state has been relatively stable and even down a little bit. So we're spreading this assessment to fewer people based on a doubling of the OMIP population. So it's not that these folks are costing us any more today than they did yesterday, other than, you know, the medical inflation that goes up. It's really the enrollment increase compared to the base we divided in, the number of people insured, is about the same.
But 150 a month, that's 1.8 a year, that's 3.6 biannual. Is a state contribution that is based on state coverage for state employees. What is?
Well, our assessment, Mr. Chair, this year will be about $30 million for the biennium, about $60 to $65 million of health insurance in the state. And the largest group in the state is PET. Mr. Chair, that kind of just gives you a quick overview of OMIP. I can answer any questions about that, or we can move to Joel. If you want to look at page 12 on the in that OMIP charts, that gives you the actual dollar amount of the assessments since our first assessment in April of 1990. And as you can see, we do it approximately every 6 months. Not
wait, are we in Section 9?
Section 12, OMIP charts.
Well,
page 11.
Mr. Chair, you know, this is so well organized. I mean, sincerely. And again, thanks to you, and I know you acknowledge your staff.
And Kelly.
So, thanks, Kelly. We know who really did this.
And she just started working on it last week, so it's just
this
amazing.
Is good. You know, this is new information. Representative Bates.
Chair, Rocky, sometimes I maybe overthink things because I've been through this so many times. The PEP assessment for OMIP is how much money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, it's not an assessment to PEP. It's an assessment to the insurer, so it would be Kaiser and the Blue Cross and small carriers.
I understand that, but the state ultimately pays those premiums
ultimately,
out.
We ultimately pay those premiums, and this current assessment is $1.39.
Well, what's that in round dollars?
Per enrollee.
What's the annual assessment then?
So there's 44,000 employees.
104,000 people covered.
60,000 family members covered for 104 times the 139. $1.39 gives you approximately $150,000 a month times 12 gives you 1.8 per year, 3.6 for biennium.
We got, and to follow up, Mr. Chair, we've got roughly 10,000 people in the program.
9,300,
Mr. Chair.
And the total cost for taking care of those people right now is?
The last 6 months, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, has been about $650 a month.
Mm-hmm. Go to Section 12, page 9. That doesn't show.
That's the loss ratio.
There's the cost right there. It's back in the OMIP section.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, you have to remember PEB's annual cost is in excess of $300 million for health insurance, so that $1 million is, you know, one-third of 1% of the total premium.
Okay, that's okay.
Representative Mark.
Thank you. And this is actually, not directed for you, but for Rick. At some point, I'd like to take a look at the claim costs by category for OMIP versus OHP versus the private market. And then this one might involve you is looking at, we had the rejection rates by company here, I believe, or at least we discussed it. And I'd kind of like to also get a picture of the letters that are written by agents. Who do they represent? Who, in other words, who are they not writing to? can we track those back through to apply them to a company?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, the answer is going to be more difficult because you have to look at every agent who may be appointed by 10 companies or may be appointed by only 2 companies. We can sit down with the agent community, look at some of our records, see what we can come up with, but I don't think it's going to be as simple.
If you can ballpark it, that would be interesting. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that kind of concludes the overview of OMIP, and I'll let Joel take it from here.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again for the record, Joel Aereo, the insurance administrator with the Oregon Insurance Division. I don't have my own charts and notebook today because I think most of the material that I'm going to cover is already in your notebooks, and I'm more or less going to come at it from a different angle, from the private sector angle. But I, too, looked at the notebooks, and I commend Rocky and Bob. Their material is very comprehensive in terms of providing a basic education in the whole marketplace, including the private sector.
It was Kelly.
I think what? Pardon?
It was Kelly.
I always give Rocky credit for his staff, but we all know that the real workhorse is here. And, of course, I have them behind me, too. Most of what we do in the private sector is not directly on your agenda, which, as I understand it, is to look at the Oregon Health Plan and the programs where the public dollars are the payers for the system. But I think we directly connect to your agenda in a couple respects. One, a lot of the actual delivery of health care with public dollars is accomplished through the private sector, through the private insurers. It's a little less true today than it's been at times in the past, but the private insurers are still very relevant, and they may become more relevant again for you as a way to deliver the health care services to the public. And then secondly, the health of the private market obviously has a direct bearing on how big the public sector plans are. If we keep the individual market healthy or healthier, then that means less stress on OMIP and so forth. And that kind of plays through all of our programs. So that's why I think what we do on the private side is very relevant to what this committee is going to be working on. What I thought I'd do, and I'll try to do this fairly quickly, I think it's again going to be basically a repeat of some of the stuff that's already been said. So I'll be trying to be quick, and then hopefully I can answer questions that people may have. We regulate on the private sector about 2 million lives in Oregon. So as it was shown in some of the charts in the book, that's about 60% of the overall marketplace. That divides into two basic chunks. The first chunk is 1.5 million people who are in large groups. That means groups of more than 50 people. I'll come back to that sector. There are a number of basic consumer protections that do apply in that sector. But frankly, we don't spend a lot of time in the insurance division with that sector because that's basically the healthiest part of the marketplace in general. Those large employers have some market leverage, are able to negotiate as well as anyone can negotiate today in the health care marketplace. There aren't as many issues of discrimination and people being singled out and having to worry about the kinds of issues that we worry about in the other marketplaces. So we'll leave that aside, and I'll come back to it at the end. The three markets that we do regulate more and where most of the discussion has been in prior legislative sessions about what exactly is the right balance of regulation and free market principles here are the small employer market. That's employer groups of 2 to 50 That's about 250,000 lives today. So that's the biggest chunk of the core regulatory responsibilities we have. The second chunk is the individual market, and that's about 170,000 lives today. And then finally, there's the portability market. Rocky has a small piece of that 1,500 lives, but that overall market is 25,000 lives. And those are the three that we spend most of our time regulating in, to the extent we do regulate in the health insurance marketplace. We basically have two kinds of regulation. The first is...
Well, let me stop you there. On the portability issue, you mentioned Rocky... You know, does a slice of it into OMIP if everything, you know, after the 18 months and the whole deal. You're picking up 25,000. Where do yours come from?
Ours are most people coming out of group coverage. The way we set up our
portability laws going into then individual policies, I'm assuming.
No, they actually. Oregon is somewhat unique this way. They stay in the group market. We set up our basic portability plan in 1995. We were ahead of the federal government, which did it in 1996. And what we did in 1995 was to say we would like people who come out of group coverage, lose their group coverage, and have therefore have portability rights. We think they should have portability rights, and the best way to handle them is to keep them with the current group. So our portability plan is basically like the COBRA plan. If you come out, if you lose your group coverage and you're with Kaiser, if you still live in the Kaiser service area, Kaiser is responsible for continuing you as a portability case of theirs. The carriers tend to like it because it's each carrier owns their own sort of a plan, and it's worked pretty well for us. I think we have one of the better portability markets in the country. In most other states, if you come out of a group plan and are portability eligible, you do go into the individual market. And sort of by definition, the insurers don't relish the portability folks, because if you come out of a group plan and you're a healthy individual, you're going to do much better by simply going in the individual market. So kind of by definition, if you're seeking portability coverage, most likely you have some kind of health problem that makes you not that makes you one of those people who's going to get rejected in the individual market. So what happens in the states where they send you to the individual market is that all the carriers there kind of game the system and try to make sure that they don't get those portability people, and then you need more regulation, and there's just been a lot of that kind of activity in other states. In Oregon, we haven't had that because you stay right with the same carrier. There's no question about who's going to get you. You stay where you are. That works for most of our portability cases.
And then if you move out of, say, a Kaiser area, then you run over to Rocky's shop.
That's right. For the people who can't, for one reason or another, stay with their current carrier, and that includes people who move out of the service area. It also includes, by that 96 law, we had to add some new people into the portability pool, which include people moving into Oregon, say, to retire. So they've just retired from a group coverage, and now they're moving into Oregon. Those kind of people, if they can't fit with their current group carrier, their alternative is OMIP with zero surcharge. And so, but in general, most of the portability issues in Oregon are being handled by the carrier who last had them in the group market. We have 25,000, and Rocky only has 1,500. So you see the numbers suggest that it's working pretty well with continuing. And it's more familiar to people. It's the same carrier. It's basically a COBRA-like system. There are different rules about premiums and that sort of thing, but it's basically that kind of system.
Representative Cruz, do you have a question?
I think Representative Bates is first.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's take the example you just cited of somebody who's working for a company. They have Kaiser Insurance, and let's say the company folds, and they have an opportunity to continue their insurance with Kaiser at a group rate. They would have to pay the entire premium, I assume. The company's gone away. How do you stay away from adverse selection there? I mean, there's 100 people drop out, a couple dozen have health problems. They obviously want to sign up for this thing. Others may say, yeah, I'm going to take my chances and leave. Is there adverse selection going on here, being dropped onto Kaiser or any other insurance company?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, yes, there is. The whole program is essentially an adverse selection type of program because, again, take your individual. If they come out of group coverage and they're healthy, they're going to do better going into the individual market. They'll have to go through health underwriting, but if they're healthy, they'll pass the test. And then because the individual market allows the exclusion of all the unhealthy people, the rates are lower. So the only people generally in portability are people who can't get good coverage in the individual market. Now, for every rule, there's an exception. There are going to be some people, they really like Kaiser and they really like the program they had and they just want to stay there and they're willing to pay for it. But you're right, they have to pay the rates. And so this is a subsidized market. The insurers lose money in the portability market because we regulate the rates and so forth in this marketplace. And it's all rooted in Oregon. We did it for the same reason the federal government did it, which is these are people who've been in the system, they've played by the rules, they've paid their premiums in group coverage, and through no fault of their own, generally, they've lost that coverage. And we decided as a society it's only fair that those kind of people get to continue coverage at some reasonable rate. So it is, you're absolutely right to say it's an adverse selection type of marketplace.
Representative Bates.
One last, maybe this is more of a comment than a question, Mr. Chair. So basically it's a mandate placed on insurers that they have to take these people if these people choose to do so. They can charge them a premium that is equivalent probably to their previous group rate, but they can't charge them a premium based on their health as they would if they went into OMIP or something of that nature. So this is really an insurance mandate we've placed on insurers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, you could use the term mandate to apply that. It depends on how you want to define the word mandate, but it is an obligation that is placed on insurers, and they do have to cover it. And the way the rating works essentially is that they can't create a separate portability pool and have that pool be self-funding. They have to rate the portability pool in connection with their whole larger group pool. So they have to blend in these people who are generally going to be higher risk into the larger pool. So in that sense, all of the people, for whatever portability people Kaiser has, they're blended in with all of the rest of the Kaiser folks in a blended kind of rate. That's how it works. I'm simplifying here, but in general, that's how it works.
Okay.
You want to Chair, just
in there?
Add one little piece to that. There are three ways that states generally provide portability. One is they do require individual market carriers to take the folks. You come out of group coverage and you've got continuous coverage, you have the right to the individual market. That has generally been very disruptive to a lot of individual markets, obviously, because you have a large influx of unhealthy folks going there, and individual markets are very small pools compared to the group pool, so you don't have a place to spread those losses. There are other states, Minnesota, Louisiana, Illinois, who use their risk pool for all portability folks. Everybody that has portability available goes into those risk pools. The problems they've had is they've charged such surcharges that an example of that is Minnesota, and they have, 8 million people in Minnesota. They have maybe 2,000 total people in portability coverage. Oregon, with 3 million folks, has 25,000, which is the other way, which is the Oregon, as well as some other states, which is to let them stay in the group market with their group carrier. So Oregon's option has been much more successful, we think, than the states that have used the high-risk pool or states that have used the individual market.
When I describe this to somebody who doesn't know the Oregon system in another state, a fellow regulator, they generally say, my God, how did you get that done? That sounds like such a better approach. And the carriers, frankly, here have been fairly satisfied with it because they like to say, well, it's our own folk. It's the people that we did insure that we're still responsible for, and it's better than trying to impose a set of new people who you know are high risk on a company that didn't have any prior relationship and so forth. So the other thing, there's a complication all the way through what I'm going to say. Some of what we do is we do because of Oregon law, and some of what we do we would have to do even if we didn't have Oregon law because the federal government would require it. We have to have a portability plan. We don't have to do it the way we do it. We could rate it different and so forth, but we do have to provide coverage for these people in some way that isn't just throwing them back on the market at whatever the market rate would be.
And I guess that's, I don't know if I object to your term, but I get the mandate.
Yeah.
Most of these, I assume, occur because of a change in employment. And so it's the same person with pretty much lost his job or transferred a job that doesn't have health insurance, and so they're in the same
same category, same health, paying the same premium now. Maybe the company was picking it up before, but whatever that rate was, same family. I don't see it as a mandate, but at the same time, as an individual, maybe that individual would have a higher premium based on his individual experience.
It's probably better. In mandates, we think of as something else, and so that's probably a bad choice. It's more of an obligation or a cost they bear, and they obviously are doing it on a willing basis this time.
Mr. Chairman, just give you one example just to kind of illustrate. I think we have this, but I'm a 60-year-old worker in a large company, and I pay some part of my premium, and the part I don't pay, I'm basically, I would get it in wages otherwise, so I'm paying for the whole premium there somehow through my employment situation. Now I lose my job through no fault of my own. Both the Oregon legislature and the U.S. Congress have made the judgment that I ought to be able to keep about the same level of coverage at about those same rates. And if I happen to be one of those 60-year-olds who's really unhealthy, I'm being carried in my group today, and I ought to be carried in the larger group that portability is part of tomorrow. That's kind of the theory of it.
But same deal if you lose the job because of your fault. You said no fault of your own, but if you're fired for whatever reason, you really screwed up, you still have the portability option.
Well, now I'm going to have to turn around and make sure. I think that's right, Mr. Chairman.
But some heads going up and down.
Somebody else, I'm pretty sure there aren't. I think there are very limited circumstances in which you're not eligible for portability, like you don't pay the premium. But I think the fact that you were fired from a job would not deprive you of portability. Am I correct? Basically, yes, comes the technical expert.
Pretty much, yes.
Pretty much, yes.
That's a firm.
You have to be pretty bad actor to get kicked out of the portability pool.
Representative Cruz.
Like if you murdered somebody, would that do it? They'd probably get fired.
Then you go to prison and get great health care, so.
Well, we've had discussions about that, too. A different question, Joel. What would it do to your demographics if we took small group from 2 to 3?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, you point to a very important issue in the current marketplace, which is that the carriers are particularly concerned about the smallest groups. Some states take the small group market all the way down to 1, and then you can get into situations where somebody claims to have a business and because they're sick and so forth, and so that's a real problem. We left it at 2 for that reason, but still then you can have a husband and wife who decide to go into business because one of them is sick. And so if you take it up to 3, then it's even harder to game the system in that kind of way. So no question but that would improve dynamics in the small group market for everybody except the real legitimate groups of 2 who would suffer tremendously under that plan, and that's the kind of trade-off that the legislature has to make.
Well, we're eligible for group, and we're more than 2. So, there's certainly a motivated self-interest there. But one of the issues is, how do we keep these things from churning, and how do we stabilize the sections of the market? That's a legitimate concern and a legitimate issue that we need to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, again, I forgot my own injunction about how a lot of these things are state and federal. The federal government requires us to go down to 2.
It does.
So we have for the core market of 2 to 25 in Oregon, we have more rate regulation than we are required to have by the federal government. We pool in a more aggressive fashion than we would have to in terms of rating. So we couldn't kick out, so to speak, the groups of 2, but we could create a different rating tier. We already have many rating tiers, so that would have its own complications that way, but we couldn't completely kick them out. We'd have to simply have a different way of treating them that was still consistent with federal law.
Okay, so we could, Mr. Chair, we could have 25 to 5 and then 5 to 2 sort of thing, if just as an off-the-wall example. We could segregate in that form?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, yes, in concept we could, and then we'd have to go back and my technicians would have to look at exactly what we could and couldn't do with that group of 2 to 5 that would stay within the federal law. We already basically have, in 1995, our small group was simply 2 to 25. And we did what we thought was a fair balancing of all the equities then, and probably today is still pretty close to a fair balancing of all the equities for that group. When the federal government said in its 1996 law, we consider small group to be 2 to 50, we then had to add the 26 to 50 group, and we did. But in those discussions, we decided not to apply a lot of the rate regulation that we had on the 2 to 25s to that larger group. So there's less rate regulation on those 26 to 50. We can come back now and say we're going to put that less rate regulation on the bottom end of the pool, too.
Chair calls on the carrier of the first controversial bill of the session.
And it was just a resolution. Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to the demographics of what type of people are there and how people are eligible. Say a person retires at 55. They're eligible for this portability pool. They go with their insurance from their own wherever they worked. And then at age 62, they're eligible for Medicare, but they like the coverage better from the one they have. I mean, can people still keep? Go ahead.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, Joel can help me with this, but go to page 6 of the initial presentation, because it really tells you what the
under
three
12?
Options of the.
No,
of,
just slide 6?
Slide 6. And it really lays out the options that you have as it relates to portability. Remember that if you work for a firm with 20 or more employees, you'll have COBRA coverage available to you. You can elect COBRA coverage, and that is for approximately 18 months with all these little exceptions. If you work for a company in Oregon that has less than 20 employees, then you can take what is called state continuation. In both of those cases, you take the exact same plan that the group offers, that your former employer offered. So you can take those, go 18 months in one, 6 months in the other, and then you have the option of portability. The state also allows you the option, either at the beginning, meaning the end of your employment, or any time while you're in COBRA or state continuation, to switch to portability. You can never go from portability back to COBRA or back to state continuation, but you can always switch over there. The other thing I think it's really important is it is not the same plan, portability, that you had in group coverage. There is what they call a prevailing plan, and I think Rick did, I don't know if you passed out what I gave. Oh, that is Nick. Gave to there. There is a specific defined portability plan that each carrier must offer. They actually have to offer two. There's two for the indemnity and two for the HMO. So if you had a $1,000 deductible plan with your employer, you left that employer, chose not to do state continuation, it's not the $1,000 deductible plan you keep. You have to purchase the $500 deductible plan that's defined as the prevailing portability, or there's a low-cost portability plan also that very few people enroll in. So there is a break both in terms, you know, when you go to that portability market, you lose the exact look-alike of the group coverage, but you go to a standardized portability plan offered by every carrier.
And just a little follow-up then, you said that a lot then dropped out when they turned 62. Then is Medicare very similar to, work similar? To, no.
No, it's
no.
It's very different.
Mr.
Better
Chair,
coverage, less coverage.
And, Medicare, I think Parts A and B is going to be very different. First of all, prescription drugs, you're not going to have that. The premium structure is very different from Medicare.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there is more complexity to this. As I was listening to Rocky and thinking of, you know, three other distinct parts of the puzzle here. I think the most important part to take out of the discussion, though, is that if you come out of group coverage, at least 6 months of group coverage in this state, or even if you're just moving into this state from having had that group coverage, you are going to have one of these portability options. It's going to be with your current carrier if you can still do that, if you're still in their area and they still can serve you. Otherwise, it's going to be into the high-risk pool with no surcharge, and you're going to basically have two choices in that market. Again, it will have nothing to do with your old coverage, even if you're still with the same group. It'll be a prevailing plan, which is kind of mid-range in the market. We just redid those plans this year. Reflecting where the market is, we've sort of downscaled them. They're not quite as rich anymore, the prevailing plan. And then there's a more basic benefit plan, a minimal plan, so something that's a little more cost-effective for somebody who really doesn't have the resources because the employer used to pay the premium and now they got to pay it themselves. So I think that market is probably our best success story. I mean, that market has been stable in the 23 to 25,000 range. The rate increases actually we're seeing there have tamed down. There were wild fluctuations in the first couple years of this program while we were trying to educate the carriers on how the rates had to correspond to the group rates. But now that that's all smoothed out, there is now, you know, pretty stable. And the rates there are probably, my actuaries will tell me, I think around 10% on average increases every year. So I think it's a success story at that point.
So just one little follow-up. So you turn 62, they could still continue on in the portability pool, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm going to answer and then turn around and make sure I'm right. I believe you have to move out of portability when you become Medicare eligible. But
I thought you'd said we could be in portability forever.
I stand corrected. You can stay in the portability plan as long as you can continue to pay the premiums. I do think at 65, when you get full Medicare, there aren't probably a lot of people that stay because there is a basic benefit in Medicare that you get, and probably it's more cost effective to be in that and then supplement Medicare than stay in portability. But I guess you can if you want to.
But why, if I've got a $1,000 deductible, I pick that off the menu of state services, and all of a sudden I'm no longer here, and I'm going into portability. Why would I have to be forced to take a lower deductible, translate a higher premium? What's the sense in that?
Mr. Chairman,
I'm not going to come and bug, you know, the system, you know, for another $500.
Mr. Chairman, again, I think you have to go back to the basic premise of this marketplace, which is if you come out of your current job and you're healthy and you can go in the individual market, you can buy pretty much whatever you want. You can buy a $1,000 deductible, whatever kind of deductible you wanted. The only people we're talking about are people who aren't healthy enough to get into the individual market. And then the legislature has basically, in its wisdom, made this judgment that rather than require the carriers to offer a whole array of plans for that relatively small number of people, just for ease of administration, we're going to keep it down to just two basic offerings. Because as soon as you tried to multiply the number of offerings, you would hear from the private market about the difficulty of maintaining a broad set of options for a relatively small group of people.
But if it's portability and I go right into, I'm still kind of with this group, you're administering, that group is administering it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, let's assume it's a small employer. You do not have to go from a $1,000 deductible plan to a $500. First of all, you can continue through state continuation your
right.
small employer plan for a six-month period.
Okay.
The second, at the end of that 6 months, you really have a couple options. Assume you don't go to work for another employer. One is, if you're healthy, you can go to the individual market.
Okay. So wait, I was backing the portability up. Well, no, I wasn't.
Okay.
Yes, you were.
You were backing it up, I think, Mr. Chair, to when you lost that job, you have another option, which is if you like that plan that you had, you could have kept that plan 6 months continuation for 6 months. If it's a large employer, you would have 18 months through COBRA. Okay, at the end of that time, then you have a couple options. One is individual market. If you're young and healthy, that's going to be the best buy for you. Second, if you're not, then you've got two options at that point. One is go uninsured. The other is portability. And within portability, there's a fork. One is a $500 deductible plan, a little higher cost. There's also a $1,000 deductible plan that has fewer benefits at a lower cost. So there is a higher benefit, higher cost, and a lower benefit, lower cost portability plan.
Okay.
So you have two forks to go when you go into the portability market.
Sounds good.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, continuing then, we were sometime a while back before we got off on portability, we were still talking about the small employer marketplace, which again, I think we should go back and reinforce how that marketplace works. And that's again, that's about 250,000 people. So it's the biggest chunk of the private market that we regulate. And there, the way the regulation works is there's no health underwriting. If you're in a small group, you get into the marketplace. You cannot be denied the small group. You can't say, gee, there are two people here that really look bad to us in terms of health. We're not going to write the group. The carriers have to carry the group. That's where we get to Representative Cruz's issue about the small, real small groups who look like they just formed the group for purposes of insurance or something. There's those issues. So that's number one, no health underwriting. Number two is you get whatever plans that carrier offers. You get your choice of them. So unlike portability where you can only get two choices, if you get into the small group market, you get every plan that that carrier has available in the small group market. If they offer it to one group, they've got to offer it to all groups. That's the second basic rule. And then the third one, which we've touched on already, is this rating regulation. We've said that the law says that all rates in that marketplace need to be within a 2-to-1 rate band, which means if $100 is the average rate in that for that particular plan, wish we had a $100 premium still, the $133 would be the highest premium you could charge any group, and $67 would be the lowest. It has to be no more than a 2-to-1 rate band. If you ask actuaries, the health actuaries, to tell you what the natural rate band is, if there were no regulation, it'd be something like 4 or 5 to 1. So it's a compression of the rate band, and what that does basically is takes the younger groups and charges them more in order for the older groups who would be charged more to pay a little less. So it brings us, some states have gone all the way to community rating. Everybody pays the same. But in Oregon, it's the 2-to-1 rate band. Some states have 3 and 4-to-1. That's another kind of reform you'll probably hear about this year in the legislature, is whether we should, quote unquote, relax our rate bands a little bit. In all of those kinds of discussions, I think one point to keep in mind is, are we talking about an issue that is reducing sort of the overall cost of the system for people, which that would not be, or are we talking about an issue of internal equity where there are some winners and some losers? This would be one of those some winners and some losers. Costs would remain the same, but some people would pay more and other people would pay less. And those are the kind of, and we went through excruciating discussion in 1995 to get to the current balance. We come back to it at least in sort of hallway conversations around here every session, and so far we haven't come up with a better balance than we currently have. But I would tell you that I hear more discussion this time from at least the carrier side about maybe it's time to relax the rate bands a little bit. But you will certainly also hear from some of the consumer groups the opposite. It's time to get to full community rating in this marketplace.
Mr. Chair, however, if we were to focus on the young, healthy individuals, relaxing the rate band would certainly be an inducement to get them into the market because they would pay more true cost of what their coverage should be. So, I mean, you're right. This is, I think that there's all sorts of implications in this thing. But if we're looking at adverse selection here, and how we deal with adverse selection, the relaxing of rate bands would, to a degree, wouldn't that have an impact on an inducement to get those who otherwise would opt for nothing to be in the market?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, that's certainly well stated as the argument for the view of relaxing the rate bands is it certainly would make the premiums more attractive to some of those younger, healthier groups, and they will tend to be the groups that are among the least insured among the small groups. On the other hand, it is going to hit the workers that are nearing retirement harder, and you'll hear, you know, their equity arguments as well. One of the arguments, though, that frankly is propelling this, one of the touchstones I use is keep my eye on how big is the small employer pool. Are we so restrictive of that pool that it's shrinking on us? Because if it's shrinking, then we're kind of counterproductive in what we're doing. And it is shrinking to some degree. Not enough to be sure that we need to do something, but it was about 300,000 lives in 1998. Today it's about 240,000 lives. So there's a 20% drop in the number of lives insured in that pool over the last 4 years. That fuels exactly the kind of argument that you just made. If you compare us to other states, though, there are states in which that small risk pool is, the bottom's dropping out. It's half as big as it used to be. They might be the states that have groups of one in the pool, for instance, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, follow up. Do you know how many I mean, we know how much that pool has shrunk. Do you know, do we know how many would be eligible that, that could be in the pool, or is that, would that be a hard number to get?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, I believe the guys with the books here could probably pull that out of their material, because we know the demographics of how many people work for those kinds of.
Right.
I mean, you know, one thing that should that used to confuse me a lot and should not confuse anyone is if you listen to people talk about, you know, 80% of the businesses in Oregon are small businesses. That's true, or even maybe more. But then you have to ask the next question of what percentage of Oregon workers are in those small businesses. It's not huge, because they're those, because one Intel makes up for, you know, thousands of these small businesses. Right. So I think we're probably dealing with, we have 240,000 in the pool. I doubt that there's more than, you know, a half a million. But Rocky, do you have something on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, on slide 28 shows you the national figures. And obviously, this was from, I think, 1996 to 2001, and it's slipped since then. But 3 to 9 workers, you know, 58% in the year 2001 offered health insurance. If you go to the 10 to 24, it's closer to 76%. Oregon has always been, up until the last couple years, about 2 or 3% better than nationally. One of the things I'll talk about Monday is the study that the Insurance Pool Governing Board is doing with Lewin and Associates to look at our group market, the most definitive look we've had of any study, teaming up with Bob DeCretz and Bruce Goldberg's shop to do a telephone survey of thousands of Oregon businesses. Who's insured? What's the benefit package? What's their cost? What's their contribution? So we're going to get some Oregon-specific information over the next 3 months, I think, that's really going to be of help to you.
Okay.
Thank you. Any evidence of this fluctuation based on kind of the economy of things better in the mid-90s and falling off in these years as dropped? Yeah. I thought earlier there was a discussion, we didn't really know if there was dropped coverage. We don't really have data, but...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe, Rick, there was a chart in here that talked, you look at the economy, it follows the premiums. And the premiums are rising, the economy is going down, and the number of businesses offering health insurance is going down. Now, I was just back in Washington, an interesting concept. As we've lost some of this group coverage in the small group market, we've also seen the individual market hold steady and in many states begin to rise. Gets back to that problem I was talking about, where employers say, take the money, go to the individual market. So a lot of states are starting to see that as their group comes down, just the switch over. It isn't that always those people go uninsured. They're just changing some of the markets they get that insurance in. Now, when premiums go down and businesses start to go up in terms of offering, what you may see in this state, which they've seen in other states historically in the early 90s, is the individual market goes down as they switch over to employment-based coverage. So a lot of times, this is just trading back and forth among different mechanisms for providing coverage.
Mr. Chairman, that is true, I think, as a general thing nationally. Unfortunately, I'm reminded of what I saw in Rocky's first slides, that the grass is brown on both sides. Right now in our market, it's not working that way, at least by the numbers we have, because the individual market, which was 200,000 lives in 1998, is now 170,000. So we're losing in both of those markets. I can't tell you the exact correlations, but there's no question, Rick, that that a bad economy makes it more difficult for employers to continue to provide health coverage, and more people lose their jobs and so forth. So bad economy certainly is an impact here. And then the health inflation is obviously even a bigger factor. In the small group market, 15% is about the average premium increase per year. Now, for us, I think you've got some material that came off of our website on sort of average premium increases for different carriers in different regions of the state. I should note, by the way, there's some inconsistencies in some of that data. We put up raw data to accommodate the public demand for as much information as quickly as possible. We simply post what the carriers report to us. We do not have the resource to go back and verify. I don't think you'd want to give us the resource to spend trying to verify every number that comes in. So some of those numbers, when they get pressed in on, turns out they're not exactly, they were reported, you know, this year was one plan and next year was a different plan. And there are some of those inconsistencies. But in the main, they give you a good view of what's happening. In the small group market, it's about 15% a year, and it's roughly that in the individual market too. It's on a smaller base because, again, if you can kick out the unhealthy people out of the marketplace, you're going to have a cheaper premium. That's that the individual market's going to be your best deal. And we do see a lot of that, frankly, the kind of interplay that Rocky talks about. There are employers now who say, gee, I'm paying, I have five employees, they're all pretty healthy and they're young, and I'm paying X amount, $700 a month or something because they all have families. I could just close down my program here and give them all, $500 a month, and they could all go out and buy better coverage. There's some of those kinds of things going on. Some of that is regulated by us. You can't do that if the employer is going to force them to use healthcare, buy healthcare with the money. But you can, an employer can close down their health plan and simply give it to people as a raise, and as long as it's not conditioned on buying healthcare, that's perfectly legal way to go. And that some of that is happening.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, and you're speaking directly to the situation my business is in right now, and that's an option we're looking at, is just giving them cash. And I guess my question was, if we relax the banding, if that would make it easier for me to afford to continue to keep them in group. So. And it's not just me. I think when we look at the people that are dropping out of insurance in the private sector, a small group is probably going to be a huge chunk of that. So, I don't know. It's a discussion for another venue, obviously. But one of my focuses since I've been in here is what do we do about the uninsured? And I hate to see situations that are creating more of them. So.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cruz, again, you make an eloquent case for that side. And part of my job is to keep all the sides on the table. And so for every argument you make like that, there's going to be somebody else that's got workers that are 58 years old, right. And it's going to be the loser in the system.
Right.
What else you got for us?
We've talked, I think, through the individual pool issues. We've talked through the portability pool issues. You asked me just to touch on mandates.
Yeah.
On the mandate question, we have a report, and I think Rick's got a summary of the report in the materials you already have, and we'd be happy to provide the full report to you.
Section
7 of the materials is the our health insurance mandates report. What we did is save the state a lot of money here by, instead of spending $500,000 or more trying to do our own intensive actuarially based study of exactly what mandates cost, we simply compiled the results of those kinds of studies done in other states. So there are five, I think, studies summarized in that report. They all come to slightly different conclusions about the mandates, but if you look at it big picture, they're surprisingly close on some of the basic points. And it essentially comes down to something like this. The alcohol and chemical dependency and mental health mandate, that complex of mandates, is about 5% of the premium dollar. The pregnancy, childbirth coverage is about another 5% of the premium dollar. And then all the rest of the mandates are somewhere probably slightly less than 5% of the premium dollar. So if you add it all up, it's 15% of the premium dollar. Now, a couple other points I think that are important here. One is, if you look at those studies carefully, the more sophisticated of them, they talk about the full cost of the mandate versus the marginal cost. And what they mean by that is that if we were to eliminate all the mandates, that would not eliminate all those costs, because many, if not most, carriers would and employers would still choose most of those coverages probably. It varies by the type of mandate that we're talking about, but the marginal costs are typically well underneath those total costs, because there's a reason why these mandates pass in the legislature, because there's some kind of public demand. There's also other factors that influence this too, but so that's the first point. And I guess I'll just leave it at that on mandates to take more questions on that topic.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there comes a point when a system or an insurance coverage is sustainable, so to speak. And I find this very interesting that alcohol and chemical dependency, mental health, and nervous
what
condition.
What page are you reading up on?
Oh, I'm looking at on page, well, there's not a page. I guess it's six of the under mandates. I was looking at Oregon.
Okay.
And that the mandates accounted for 8.1% of all claims. And I guess my question to you is then, small businesses have to cover all of those? If they offer an insurance program, they have to provide those? A small business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes. The mandates apply to all group coverages, and that includes the large groups, too, that we, again, largely don't directly regulate. There are still a number of laws that do apply in that marketplace, and all of the mandates are one of them, and a number of the mandates also apply in some form or fashion in the individual marketplace, too. So, again, this is an issue that gets visited every legislative session. Should we have some kind of approach that either eliminates mandates wholesale or eliminates them for certain kinds of situations? Rocky's got a mandate from charge from the last legislative session to develop a plan that wouldn't have to include the mandates. It's run into some problems with the federal government standards, but that's a discussion every session is should we have plans out there that don't comply with these mandates.
Well, follow up, please. One of the slides, I don't remember where, you, Rocky, I think you were saying that there were businesses just not, they're dropping their insurance. And this is the main reason, I can't remember what that slide said. The main reason was the high cost of premiums.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the number one cost people or the employers are faced with is the raising of the higher premiums they have to pay every year. But remember one thing about reducing mandates. Let's say that Joel's figure's right, 15%, and you're paying $600 a month, and you pull out all those mandates and say there is no marginal, it's a real 15% reduction. So what are you going to save, $60? So your premium goes from $600 to $540. 30% or 20% increase the next year, you're right back to $600. That 15%, while it is going to save some, there's no question that there's a point at which they say, I'm not going to provide it. But you come back the next year, you're right, it's a one-year savings. You're right back up there. The other thing I wanted to point out, if you have questions on the mandates, in that Section 7, the next to the last page, is a list of all of the Oregon mandates. I don't know if you've actually been able to see
what that. Section is
page 17 and 18 of the of that
section
report.
It was also a handout that Rick gave
also
us.
Also,
Couple things chart in there.
Again,
let me just make one other point here in relation to the mandates. Remembering that state-federal interplay, you got to ask this question every time you're thinking about any of these changes. Is, well, how much of it's going to be required by the federal government? Even if we try to change it in Oregon, and on the mandate question, some of it will still be there. So exactly what part we'd have to look at more carefully, but there are federal bases for some of the mandates. And give you the other side, too. While you're talking about reducing or eliminating mandates, you'll also see a strong push in this session to expand the mental health mandate to full mental health parity. So these are tough questions that you can see both sides of.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
First, an observation. I find it very interesting that the feds don't require mammography, but they require reconstruction. I just find that very interesting. Federal Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act, which is breast reconstruction. But Rocky, I thought you said yesterday that self-insured weren't subject to mandates, but according to this list, they are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I said there were two federal mandates, one that applied to all ERISA programs and group programs. One is the Federal Women's Health Act, and the second, I believe, is the Newborn Children and Mothers Health Protection Act. Those are the only two mandates that I'm aware of, and I think they're in this chart.
Newborns is 10 at the top.
Yeah. Number 9 and number 10.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, that is another important distinction. When I said that these mandates apply in a large group market, part of the discussion we didn't yet have is, in the large group market, the private sector, it's split between insured plans, which are covered by whatever kind of laws are passed in this body, and then there's the self-insured portion of that marketplace, right, which is not, which this body can't reach. And there's a lot of dispute about exactly how many lives are in each side. It's probably somewhere around half and half. You get different numbers from different people, but it's very complicated. We don't have data on that. And just to illustrate the complexity of this, if you went to some place like Intel and saw their benefit offerings, some of the benefit offerings, they'd all have probably insurance company names on them. Some of them would be plans where they're really insurance plans and the insurance company is taking the risk and Intel is sort of just paying a premium and they're off the hook. Others will be still an insurance company name on it, but will be called what's called an ASO contract, administrative services only, which means all the insurer is doing is processing claims. It looks to the employee, same exact thing, but behind the scenes, the Intel is keeping the risk on that plan. So the insurer is just getting paid to process everything, but not to take any risk. And so every year people choose up and these numbers just change, but some significant portion of the 2 million that we regulate, at least a third and probably more like 750,000 or 800,000 of those lives, are in the self-insurance market. And whatever laws we pass here only apply to the other parts of the market. And then, of course, you have this argument that if you do too many of those laws, the 800,000 is going to keep growing larger. And the regulated parts are going to grow smaller. And there's some dynamic in that direction.
But the self-insureds are subject to all federal mandates or just those two?
Just those two, 9 and 10.
Well, there's not a lot of federal mandates on this list,
Mr.
number
Chair,
one.
Representative Cruz, there are two federal mandates.
And that, those are the only two. But one would assume if the feds mandated something else, self-insureds would be subject to that also.
Those are the two benefit provider mandates.
Right.
There may be other requirements for ERISA plans that Peggy probably can get into.
Okay. Federal. I'll talk to Peggy about that later.
Question. Just to clarify, I think the chart shows vendor and condition mandates. There's really, and again, how you interpret a host of other mandates that fall outside of vendor and condition that the federal government require of
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bacobian, yes, that's correct, depending on how you define the term. Representative Bates defined it to include portability. Today, some people do that and broaden the category. You can, if you broaden it to include all, you can include all the financial regulation of companies if you want to, and you can get that number significantly higher, but this is generally the core of mandates because these are the special things that are added on that you have to put these benefits in the package. The rest of the things are more, I would call them kind of rules of the road about how the marketplace should operate, all of which, you know, when you say no health underwriting, that has a big cost in the marketplace because it drives up premiums. But it's very hard to sort of quantify that as a mandate per se.
Joel, do you have any regulatory capacity in the sense of that example here probably, but a public utilities commission, PUC, where you look at rates for given companies, given parts of the market?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have rate regulation authority. It's oftentimes contrasted, though, to the Public Utility Commission, where there's some express language in their statutes that have to do with how the rates, you know, will affect the public and affordability and that sort of thing. In the insurance world, it's always been the tradition that the standards of review for rates are actuarial soundness. So we get a rate increase in, and we have our actuaries look at it, and it's different in different markets. So all the markets I talked about are prior approval markets. We look at the rates before they can be put into the marketplace. We don't look at the large group rates, but the small group, the individual, and the portability, we look at all those. But our standard of review is, can the company show that its costs are such that they need these rates to maintain a going business? And if they do, then all other factors are not relevant. There's a famous story of the current governor, when he was insurance commissioner, holding a hearing on MedSup, which is a seniors product, and heard like an hour of testimony from people. This is the last time I think we had a rate hearing. in Oregon in the early 90s and heard an hour of testimony about what a hardship this would work on the marketplace. After that was done, he sort of took the statutes out and read the standards of review and said, the problem I'm having is how all of this testimony gives me any ground on which to make any decision to disapprove this rate increase under these standards. No one could really answer that question, and that was kind of the end of the discussion. So that is still how it's set up. You could hear from some consumer groups who say we ought to take that into consideration, but then I'd hear from my financial guys that, you know, we're putting insurance companies at risk and that sort of thing. And I can tell you, when I came into this job, I thought that I was more of the consumer protection side, but when you see what happens if the companies go insolvent, you quickly decide that the worst thing that can happen for consumers is that the company goes insolvent, and then we're not dealing with whether they're fair to consumers and how they pay out claims. We're dealing with they don't have any money to pay out on claims. So solvency is very important, and that's kind of been the touchstone of the regulation to today. Now, that doesn't mean there's not some judgment calls in here. There always are, but that's the basics.
Well, and that's the angle I was coming from, is this is insurance, and, you know, it's kind of like budgets, two things. It's about a budget. One is how big is it, as we've recently learned, how certain is it? You know, insurance is what's the rate, and how guaranteed am I going to be that they're going to be there when I need them? So, I mean, that's the angle I was coming at. And so, I mean, is there some internal actuarial function that you go through as an agency to say, yeah, okay, at this premium under these different policies, this different client mix, if you will, they're going to make it, they'll be there? And I'm hearing you say, yeah, you do.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the answer to that is yes. We have one, to give you a sense of proportional, we have one life and health actuary. So there's one person in my department who's a certified top-notch actuary, but just one, to review all of the health filings. And he does go through all of them. He asks questions where he sees issues. The companies have to provide actuarial memoranda to justify the rate increases that they're, when they're seeking rate increases or decreases, for that matter. I mean, there's, in insurance regulation, there really is a fundamental clash where in the morning I could be talking to my financial people who are saying, thank God X companies pulled out of Southern Oregon now because they were losing their shirt down there, and now they're going to be in much better shape. And then in the afternoon, my consumer protection people come in and go, we've got a real problem because X companies just left the market high and dry, and consumers are going to be in real trouble down there, and we need to force them back in there. So there's those kinds of clashes that go on.
Poor choice, but an example, of course.
Hypothetical.
Well, we can't pick anywhere in Oregon with this committee. So this happened in Washington.
Yeah, that happened in Washington.
Oh, yeah. Northern Oregon.
Ontario.
But you only do that for the small groups? You don't do that for the large groups?
No. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We don't review rates in the large group. A couple years ago, for comparison purposes, partly to deal with this portability question and whether the companies were really doing the rating fairly with portability and pooling it in group, we did get some information from the large group market, which tended to indicate that the rate increases were in the roughly the same kind of a ballpark. And I think there's a Mercer study that you have in front of you that sort of canvasses employers and gets some of that data. But we do not have our own data. If you look at our webpage, it's all about groups up to 50, and then we don't have our own data on the larger groups. There are people, again, who propose that we ought to have a lot more data like that to have a better view of the healthcare marketplace. So far, that hasn't been persuasive to the legislature, but that's been proposed.
And you're statutorily prohibited from doing that?
Mr. Chairman, no. We under the insurance code, we have the authority to ask for whatever information we want from companies to try to get a handle on the marketplace. It's a difficult proposition in a large group market because it tends to be a sort of individually negotiated rates, and it's a very, I mean, we'd spend a lot of resource trying to try. It'd be sort of like when you try to pin down the drug companies on what's the real price and how do the discounts really work and that sort of thing. It gets into fairly complicated terrain. But if we were charged to do that, we'd probably come back and say we might need a couple more people to make it meaningful, but we could do it.
Completely off these topics, Mr. Chair. Okay. There's something the IRS just allowed called health-related accounts.
Called a what?
Health-related accounts, HRAs. Are you familiar with those?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I believe that you're talking about the accounts that are the underlying thing for MS8 and medical savings accounts.
It's
and,
going to be
and the tax deductibility, the money, and the carryover, the money, that. Okay, yeah. Then I'm not familiar with the term, but I'm familiar with the concept.
Well, they've just recently changed the regulations on it. I'm not asking for answers right now. What I'd like to have you do, if you could, is research that and bring it back to me. I've read a couple articles about it. It might be something that would be worthwhile for us to look at in this committee, but it may not be. It's something new.
Yeah, that would. I mean, they set those in 96, I think. So this.
Yeah, they made a change last year in the tax code, I understand, that allows you to do something a little different with them. And I don't want. I know what I've been told. I don't know if it's real or not, but it's something we might want to look into.
What's the basic concept?
Basic concept is, correct me if I'm wrong, is you can put a couple $1,000 into your HRA, and then it rolls over every year. You have about a $2,000 deductible between $2,000 and $4,000, and then after that you buy stopgap insurance as part of the program. That HRA keeps rolling forward every year, and if you're careful with spending, the concept being that you have some control and some responsibility for how you spend that money. And as it rolls forward each year, if you're careful, pretty soon you haven't got any deductible anymore. But there's something else to it. When you turn 65 or any time down the future, if you decide your health care needs are taken care of by Medicare or whatever, you can draw that money out for other purposes. So you own that money.
It's a medical IRA.
Yeah.
So.
And what it does is it puts the individual in control and helps hold down utilization because they think twice about going. And that's the concept behind it. But I don't. My details may be wrong, and I wouldn't want to be quoted on that as being correct.
Mr.
That's
Chairman,
conception.
Representative Bates, that's an accurate description from my perspective. We've had this concept of medical savings accounts since 1996, which essentially are, if I today pay $5,000 for a relatively rich benefit plan, I could pay $2,000 next year or $3,000 for a plan that had a high deductible, like $2,000. Then my employer will give me that extra $2,000 that they're saving in this cheaper plan, and I'll put that in this account. And so I'll use that money to pay off my medical expenses until I reach my deductible. And one of the obstacles to a lot of people using that kind of plan has been that when they don't use up that money, then they can lose it. And so there's always moves to make the tax treatment of that money more favorable, allow it to be rolled over. And it sounds like under HRAs it's made about as favorable as it can be. I just don't know the details of that particular proposal. But that would fuel that. That is consistent, I would say, with one of the dominant trends in the private market. If you talk to the carriers, say, about, you know, where are we going with the market, one of the things they'll say is we have to get to a marketplace in which people have more skin in the game. They have, you know, whether it's the government or an HMO or the doctors, there's just nobody who's probably going to be very good at telling somebody, you know, you paid me a fixed premium and now I expect to get everything I need medically from you under that fixed premium. Nobody's going to stay at the door and say that you can't get it. So it's more like we got to move towards a system in which, well, if you want to get it, you can, but, you know, we'll pay a little bit, and you'll pay a little bit of it yourself, too. That kind of concept is more and more, you know, higher employee contributions. All of those things are what's there. Of course, the huge problem with that is the people who can't pay. That system tends to favor, you know, the people who are healthier, who store up their money, and then you end up maybe with more people coming back. It would complicate this committee's mission because the people who are unhealthy, who used up all that account or for whom it wasn't even attractive at all, then eventually they end up in a public system under those systems. So it's got its, you know, again, it's like everything here. Health will always be with us because no matter which way you push on this, something else over here is going to be a problem as soon as you do this.
Yeah, but with those, we could lower those hospital reimbursement rates, right, Bruce? And then when the shift came to the private and commercial side, they'd be even,
right?
Because their premiums would be lower because they had higher deductible. That's it.
Can we go home now?
Bruce is not shaking his head one way or another. I mean, you know.
He's thinking of the stock.
Chair, we will put together a short slide presentation. We've been working on the HRAs and MSAs concept, so we can give you some overview next week as part
That'd
of the
That'd be great. That'd be really great.
And
one last question.
Senator Morris has been working on that. I don't know if you've contacted him. Okay.
Yeah, we've been asked by Senator Morris to provide information on that, too, already.
Okay.
Yeah, get him down. Representative Bates.
One last question, and this is absolutely not to be answered today. There's no way. We've listened now for a week to the most Byzantine system of providing health care the world's ever seen, hopefully ever see again.
And the most expensive.
And the most expensive, and that's what we're going to here. The idea of how we've set this up is that competition among insurance companies will drive down, hold down costs. It's gotten so complex now for the average consumer, they have a hard time wading through the system. And the question of whether we're really driving down costs and holding down costs of competition is an open question. My question to you is, can you in any way decipher what kind of money is being used in the system just to maintain the administrative load of all these competing and complex and confusing programs? And the next question being, if you were the czar and could put out a floor of some type for these insurance companies to compete with each other on, because that's still the basis of a good program, is there one that can be conceived of to be done? And I'll just leave it there.
Good question.
Two very big questions.
Good question.
I'm glad you said we didn't have to answer them today.
I may not be late.
Oh, it's 5:30?
Yeah.
We'll be back at 5:30.
Yeah. Any other questions? Good committee. Thank you both very much. Rocky, see you on Monday.
See you Monday.
Any other business? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
You need a smaller gavel.